Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about my favorite subject, well, my two favorite subjects, food and taste. And today, we're having that conversation with one of my favorite people. It's very exciting here. We're actually in a little satellite studio high above Midtown Manhattan, and we're talking with the newly awarded Outstanding TV Personality of the Year, given by our organization, the James Beard Foundation, Andrew Zimmern. Thanks for being here, Andrew. We're so excited to have you.
Likewise. This has been more than a year in the making. No one I'd rather talk about food with.
Well, that feeling is mutual, and I appreciate you taking the time out of this busy awards weekend to give us a few minutes to chat about our mutual favorite subjects.
You know, if you have croissant and hot coffee, and it's a Saturday morning in New York, and I could walk from my hotel in this beautiful sunlight on a gorgeous spring day, it just feels like all is right with the world. It's a happy time.
Well, here at Heritage Radio Network, we like to make people happy. So there are so many things that we could talk about, Andrew, and in anticipating your arrival today, I thought I'd like to pick up a conversation that we began over a year ago, and that was about what you do. I mean, you are the host of Bizarre Foods America. You have taken people with you into so many unusual and exotic places, eaten some unusual things and delicious things, and I think it adds a component of our conversation about taste that we have here on the show that is really interesting for people to explore. You wrote a little bit about it for us for the James Beard Foundation, but talk about where that fits into the larger project of gastronomy that we're all participating in.
Well, I mean, there's so many different levels of ideas about how we eat globally as a people. Mm-hmm. And there's so many sides to this diamond. It's been cut and faceted 64 or 80 different ways, and in multiple combinations, there's a limitless way of factors that tell us why we eat, how we eat, where we eat, and I think most importantly, how we feel about what we eat. Not the comfort side of the equation or the pleasure-seeking side of the equation, but how we feel about what we put into our mouths. That tastes good. That texture does not make me happy, and things like that. Certainly with Bizarre Foods, it can be viewed two ways. 80% of the people see it as an entertainment program. Oh, that's the guy that goes around the world and eats bugs. 5% of them see it as a travelogue, although as a travelogue, we probably do a pretty crappy job because we're focusing on other things. We're not going to walk you from the boat station down the dirt road to the place, hand on the doorknob, right, turning, open the room. Sort of Rick Steves experience.
You'd be hard-pressed to make your itinerary after watching one of your shows, although it may inspire you to want to go somewhere.
And strangely, and this is, I mean, the biggest surprise of my career is that over the last 8 years and the shows in 70 countries, how many people email me saying, because we put it up on websites, right, Here's where I went, we went to so-and-so and ate everything you ate. It's crazy how many people do that. But it speaks to the question that you raised, which is that 15% of our show, and to me it is the most important 15%. I curate and caretake it like a very delicate egg. Is this idea that by exploring what other people eat, how they eat it, we can teach ourselves how to be better citizens of planet Earth. We can open our eyes to making our own food lives better by exporting back into, for the sake of our American audience, their lives, real nuts and bolts attitudes about food that will change the way they relate to food on the table. You know, there's a lot of talk these days because, you know, Pollan's new book, Cook, just came out, and, you know, his famous phrase that was not in Omnivore's Dilemma, it was in others' book about that it's now repeated across every masthead in every magazine, newspaper in America, don't eat so much, mostly plants. I'm right. Getting it wrong, but we're all aware of the Pollanism that came out of that book, inspired by Wendell Berry. And people in our show can see different ways of eating relating to food and think, you know, saying, I'm not going to eat fried bats the way the Lhasu do in Thailand, or that essentially raw goat gut stew that I ate with the himba, or some of the more shocking sort of tribal things. But maybe it makes them a little easier to put a third vegetable on their plate at dinner time and have a different attitude about their own food life. And I think that's the great contribution that Bizarre Foods has made. And you know, things happen in certain circles that then dribble out into the rest of our pop culture mainstream. And I was sitting in the room last night at the Media Awards, at Media and Journalism Awards, and I stopped counting when I hit 12 people who've been in my show, either as a character or as a guide, okay, which is fascinating. Mostly none of them are chefs. All in that room nominated for something. Jesse Griffiths for A Field. Some of the guys at, is it Dark Rye,
yes,
the website, were my guides going monkey-faced eel hunting in our show. Obviously, lots of famous chefs in the room. But, so you know, Hank Shaw, who won for Hunter, Gardener, Angler, Cook.
Did I get that right? Yeah, I think
I reordered them for Hank. All these people over the course of the years have been in our show before they develop their own expertise fully as it is today. And I was so proud of that. And my wife said to me, well, how does that feel? I said, well, it makes me feel great about the potential for food life change in America, because it shows that we really are fairly quickly able to get away from the idea that people can only do web or podcast or write about Italian regional cooking. And it, exactly.
Right.
And it doesn't, I'm not anti-Italian regional cooking. I'm pro idea. Mm-hmm. I think the more ideas that are on the table, the more places we can choose from, the better off we all are, because we then are talking more about the things we have in common and less about our differences, which I think is important.
I'm talking with Andrew Zimmern, who is host of, among other things, Bizarre Foods America on the Travel Channel, and the recent recipient of the James Beard Foundation's Outstanding TV Personality Award for 2013. If you're listening to the podcast, remember that you can write us questions for Andrew, for me, or just about anything about food, and send them to info@heritageradionetwork.org. Or if you can also tweet us, if you prefer 140-character questions, to TasteMattersHRN. What we're really talking about, it seems to me, and the thing that I find so compelling is culture. I mean, that food is culture. It isn't just nourishment. And from the cultural anthropologist's perspective, what is food for some and non-food for others, I think, is an endlessly fascinating question. I mean, it goes to the root of anthropology and understanding other people. And as you say, I mean, in the room at the James Beard Book Broadcast and Journalism Awards, but also in the dining rooms of restaurants around the world. I mean, Rene Redzepi is cooking up ants and live shrimp and all those sorts of things. And there was a time in our own culture when raw fish, a.k.a. sushi or crudo or whatever, would have been the most bizarre thing anyone could ever imagine eating. So where do you think we are going? Where is all this where are you taking us?
It's just an endless delight for me. To see those kinds of things happen and to go halfway across the world and to bump into, the folks at Noma and a lot of other restaurants around the world who clap me on the back and say, you know, thank you so much for opening up people's eyes to this on the mainstream side of the equation. And I'm flabbergasted. I'm flabbergasted. And then I sit back and I'm so delighted with the change. You know, that when the very first episode of Bizarre Foods that we made 9.5 years ago as the pilot, I've spent time with 7 of the 12 world's hidden tribes. And the Lhasu, who live basically as they always have up in the hills of northern Thailand, left alone by everyone, mostly because they're in the middle of the Golden Triangle and no one will go in there. We took a Jeep up to the top of the mountain to share a meal with them. So they're you know, the drug lords and the international narco traffickers who control everything below 2,000 feet above sea level gratefully let us in. Sort of the story of our lives. You always have to get to tribal peoples. It turns out most times you have to go past international narco traffickers. It's and that's true.
It's the order of the world.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. And we get up there and we eat bats. And the bats are sizzling in the cook tent, the cook hut, and the one of the older shamans is tossing them, and a couple of the moms come in, and they're setting the communal table. They eat communally, the lasu. And I hear feet, and I look at my cameraman because I give him that look like, wow, tilt up from he's shooting me eating or poking inside in the pot, and I'm giving him that look. I hear someone coming, get the shot at the door because I'm going to turn and look, and I realize they're children. And they're all running to – they're plucking bats out of the oil with their fingers, you know, because the wings kind of stick out as – they always do when you're frying bats.
Oh, of course. You know, I have a special pot from Alclad makes the bat fryer. Yeah.
You have the 6-quart though. They only had the 3-quart. And so he pulls out – these children are pulling out the bats, and they're doing the same thing American kids do with pizza right out of the oven or fish fingers or chicken wings. I mean, it's the exact – the faces are the same. The parents are the same. The admonitions are the same. I don't speak – they speak in clicks and whistles, but grandmothers are hitting kids on the hand, and the one bad kid is turning in the corner so he can get in his mouth before anyone stops him. And I – at one point I'm watching this and I realize all the people who say, well, my kids don't like fish – so that's why my kid doesn't eat fish. And kids don't like green things. Or kids don't like squishy things. None of us are genetically disposed to not like something. We, our animal nature, our being, right, will eat anything. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And all you have to do is watch kids in other countries. Why I became fascinated with kids and write kids' books and all the rest of that kind of thing, because I think children is where we need to get them. Because what happens is culture and society rubs up against us. And you know, our son eats everything, but he won't eat worms because he had a book, one of those cardboard kids' book on his bookshelf called Yummy Yucky, and there was a page that said worms are yucky. Pop culture got to him in one sentence before I did. And he only read that book 2 or 3 times before he outgrew that phase of his, you know, learning abilities. And yet it's still ingrained in his head. So he'll eat rotten fish. Over, he'll eat guinea pig. He eats bugs with me. He eats all because I got to him first. Daddy says it's okay, but he won't eat worms wherever we are. They're served because they and he uses the word they're yucky. They're yucky, even though he doesn't realize where he learned it from. So I think the value of what we're doing is taking a look at that and realizing that if we can show pictures of grandmas and kids and everyone merrily eating something. Maybe the next time someone's overseas, they may not eat bat, but they'll eat the other strange thing in front of them that every part of their being says, this is not what I eat. And then when you do eat it, you realize there's a right and a wrong way to cook everything. Mm-hmm. Thomas Keller, I had the pleasure of working for him for years, and he always told us that there was a right and a wrong way to cook something. Just like the Impressionist painters in France who – they went to the École des Beaux-Arts. They could draw still life as it was a picture. They were incredible realist painters. But it wasn't until Monet could draw a haystack as it looked in real life that he could draw one as he was impressed by it. Seurat, the pointillist, brilliant, brilliant, almost a photorealist in early in his career with charcoal. They're able then to do their version of it. I think chefs around the world, you know, Reni Redzepi being a very famous example, is someone who can be raised in an environment, the foraging thing in the Nordic countries and the Scandinavian world is epic and legendary. I've spent a lot of time traveling there, shot a lot of shows there, and everything is gathered and produced and heavy-duty seasonality by cultural, by historical and
necessity.
And so all these foods and experiences born of necessity, these people can actually access that and present it in a different format where people are interested. It's what fascinates me about guys like Redzepi. It's why when people make the claim that, you know, cooking something sous vide is somehow impersonal, I'm like, you're just looking at it at this microsecond of time. You're not looking to the left and to the right and seeing where this plays in general. There's a movie called Stand By Me about the little kids that go on that little escape, and there's a scene in that movie that I think applies to food and trend and culture. They at one point they're lying on the broken down bridge and they look down, and all they see is the rushing water below them, and one of them gets scared and everything. And but there's a lot of other stories happening at the same time all around them that different ones pick up on. There's a train coming. It's green and sunlight and beautiful. It's actually deeper in the water behind them. It's where the calm water is after the rapids. I think so often when we're looking at food and culture, we're just looking at it with blinders on, and we only see what's right in front of us instead of the bigger picture, which I think is a closed-minded way of looking at things. It's you can't live in anything but the present. However, you can look around you and see where things are headed and where they're going and learn from the past and from – you learn from the train and how deep the water is and where the sun is and how tall the trees are. You got to look around.
We're talking with Andrew Zimmern, and I'm sure you understand why, because he's opening our minds as he does our palates on his show Bizarre Foods America, and in all of his other work. We'll talk more about his other stuff when we come back. This is Taste Matters.
This is the story of men and women who shed not only their clothes, but also their...
This one's called Blazin' Fish Cakes by Rectech, and you are listening to Taste Matters on heritageradionetwork.org.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. We're talking with Andrew Zimmern. And remember, you can ask us questions by email at info@heritageradionetwork.org and also by tweeting us at Taste Matters HRN. Also remember that Heritage Radio Network is a member-generated, member-supported radio station, just like your friends over at NPR, only we're a little smaller, and we appreciate your membership just that much more. So for just $60, you can go to the website, heritageradionetwork.org, support us, give us more if you want, come to some of the member benefits, parties, all sorts of fun things at Roberta's. Anyway, we'll look forward to welcoming you into the Heritage Radio Network family. So you said something that I think is important about getting kids when they're young and impressing them, and you mentioned the effects of pop culture, and also I would add peer pressure, I mean, which Stand By Me is sort of a perfect example of. But one thing that's always on my mind is we forget that adults' tastes change also. I remember the day, it was October 6, 1989, and I'm not even kidding, that I began to like blue cheese. Mm-hmm. And I was in France, and it happened to be my birthday, which is why I remember the date. And the family I was staying with, I was in college, bought me a Roquefort, a special Roquefort for my birthday, and I wanted it. You know, I didn't say, ooh, it's disgusting, it tastes like sweat socks, which I would have said on October 5th of 1989, and I took it. And I just wonder if we could talk a little bit about what the implications for change are, even just on a larger scale for that.
There's, again, several different aspects of that story that I that I have tremendous amount of experience with. The first is, like my wife growing up in Minnesota with fish, most of the Roquefort's blue cheese or vein cheeses you had probably weren't that good. They're a little older. They're a little sweaty. They've ammoniated a little bit. I tell people all the time, don't judge your blank food by the six times at, you know, your family's bar mitzvahs and weddings that you had it at the country club, because they always put out an old wheel of it. When you're in the place, there's a specialness to it, oftentimes related to quality, that is going to tip the scales. We all have friends that go away to their trip of the decade to whatever country and come back and say, you know, we'd always eat, but we finally ate shrimp with the heads on it. Well, of course you did, because there they came right out of the water. And the ones that you always had at restaurants around here were just one day too old, you know, and they're not as pleasant to eat. Fresh sea urchin, really fresh sea urchin, pristine sea urchin, has a layered and a nuanced effect as you're eating it, an aroma that comes back through your nose that inspires pleasure in more people than the stuff that's a little tired does.
I'm still waiting for that experience to happen with my husband, Nate, because he's had the best you can have in Tokyo, and he's still, it's the texture. It actually isn't the flavor, but anyway.
Same with my wife. And there are people who are, I mean, look, I don't like walnuts. You know, I've tried them a million ways, can't get past it, don't like the soapy smell and aroma. I don't eat walnut. I mean, like, really.
Did you hear that, everybody? Andrew Zimmern thinks the most disgusting food in the world is a walnut. Anyway.
I won't eat oatmeal. Love oatmeal cookies. Love grinding, toasting, grinding oatmeal and using it as a part of a flour.
Yeah, of course.
Whatever I'm doing. Yeah. But I can't eat a bowl of oatmeal. Okay. However, I will eat every kind of perverse congee all over Asia to the degree that people, my friends, laugh at me because I'm like, yeah, give me more of that 1,000-year-old egg in there and throw some of that unwashed tripe. And it just I just love congee, but I can't stand oatmeal. I think as human beings, we have an ability to put a different part of our mind to work to give us a little bit of willingness to try it, and we'll squeeze open those blinders in a way that others can't. I think as we get much, much older, I find myself getting more set in my ways in other aspects of my life. I think I'm probably not the right person to judge in terms of how I do my food life, because I'm such an explorer and I'm so hell-bent on trying new things, because the most valuable piece of real estate I have in my brain is this world of tastes and flavors and food experiences that I've spent 30 years curating. And when you spend that much time curating it, you have to have more. I mean, I have a disease of more. I don't want to be the person that doesn't experience that one plant on that one island that they make that one salad with. Taste and culture, you know, there's so much of it that is subjective, but I do think that there is a learned experience to it, and that we can keep walking down the same street from a culinary standpoint and re-experience something until we bump into the right way to cook it. I remember there's a giant coconut grub called an uwok. It's one of the more disgusting things in the world. People recoil from it in markets all around Asia and South America. It lives in dying coconut trees, and it eats the rotted wood. So the stomach is filled with rotted wood. Mm. When they're cooked, in some cultures, they simply pan fry them for 45, 50 seconds. Essentially just let them crawl through a warm spot in the kitchen, and then they serve them. It's a horrific item. I've had to choke down quite a few because I'd rather be a better guest in a native home than – I may be the only, you know, white American they ever see. And I want to make sure that I do well in those situations.
For which we all thank you.
Very, very important. And then one day – so I had this dish four or five places around the world, and I was fairly unimpressed. And then I'm in the town of Coca on the Pilchi River in Ecuador, and I'm about to take a two-day canoe ride to meet up with the Pilchi Indians, a hidden tribe that lives deep, deep in Lake Pilchico at the end of the river. And I'm very hungry, and I smell this incredible sort of like – it smells like a ham skin roasting. 'Cause, and I realize, no, it's not that. That's not what it is. It's – It's the orange juice caramelizing on something that makes me think of ham skin. And I'm getting hungrier as I'm thinking about this. And I'm with my crew and I'm like, we got to look for smoke. Look, because it's a dense pack market. So I want to look for a vendor. You can see smoke above someone's head. And I see smoke. And I walk over. It wasn't a papal conclave. It was a UWOC grilling station. A guy had taken a little garbage can, filled it with wood, lit it on fire, put a grate over the top of it. And he had a bucket, and he was skewering these UWOC. I mean, they're the size of your thumb. I mean, wow. It's a really sort of heinous thing. But his looked oddly flat. And I was looking at the woman behind him. His wife was cleaning them with her finger, taking out the stomach, dropped them into a bucket of wild sour orange juice, was skewering them, and they were grilling them. And then at the end, much in the same way that here when you buy street meat in New York, they put a piece of stale, crappy French bread on the end. She put it a piece of steamed yucca, okay? And they hand it to you for, I don't know, 20 cents, right? And it had six or seven of these things that were all crispy. They looked like the Pope's nose, you know, that part of the chicken that crisps up at the back. Now, in a yakitori bar in Japan, five or six of the Pope's nose on a yakitori grill, a little ginger juice basted in that traditional, you know, rock sugar soy sauce, rice wine glaze on it is one of my favorite treats in the whole world. This was better. They had preserved the best parts of the UWOC, which is the crispy, fatty skin, taken away the part that was gross, which is the sort of pus bag of wood that sits in the middle, seasoned it perfectly with sour orange juice. I mean, brilliant cooking, and then grilled it so it crisped up. And all I remembered was Thomas Keller's admonition to me the first time I picked up a knife in his kitchen, which was, you have to know how to cook it right. There's a right way and a wrong way to cook everything. And then once you do it the right way, you can then freestyle it and you can do UWOCs with a little soil and a foraged thing and a little, you know, glass of UWOC soup next to it and do a composed dish. That's not far-fetched. And I think we're getting to the point in the world, chefs are fetishizing ingredients, always have, right? Always have. And I think they're eager to learn how to cook and prepare these things. And chefs are now more mobile. People can come to them. And while there's a part of me as the cultural anthropologist, and certainly on the culinary side, I want people to go to Sardinia to have the fragola at, you know, my friend's restaurant, where I think it's the best in the world and, you know, certainly in the part of the world where they know what they're doing with fragola. But now Andreini is coming here and working with chefs and imparting a new – and now fragola is like white hot. When I went over to Sardinia and did my show, I never saw it on a menu for 20 years. Now everywhere I go, fragola, fragola, fragola.
And you should just say what it is because not everyone will know it.
It's a tiny – it looks like the size of Israeli couscous. It's actually a small, tiny hand – should be hand-formed pasta.
Toasted
and then boiled. And they the great thing about fragola is that – sort of, it's like quick risotto in the sense that then you can put it onto a plate. And at Andreini and a lot of the Sardinian restaurants, they put a seafood broth, almost like a bouillabaisse reduction, and all kinds of seafood around it. And you use a flat spoon and pull it up. Okay. So,
That sounds great. Speaking of that regional Italian cuisine that we were just shunning moments ago, right?
But there is something, you know, whether you're, you know, I want people to have the total experience. Walk down the street by the wharf and find your way into Andreini. It's not that easy to find. To me, that's the magic of travel. And I know talking to you, I'm preaching to the converted, that the sum total of that experience is maybe what makes his fragola taste better. It may not be what's actually on the plate. And I think that's something to get back to your question about adults, that adults can have their minds changed over. As adults, we're willing to change our ideas about things because of the status experience of collecting those little, you know, being able to sit at a cocktail party and said, well, have you ever wandered down the street in Alghero to find Andreini's place, is the filthy lucre of our time. You know, so we want, I think as adults, that's where we can get them. Kids, they'll try anything, you know.
Right, unless they're made fun of for their lunch or something. But, right, and then they won't ever eat it again. Thank you, Andrew. It's such a pleasure to have you here. And I just feel so fortunate to be able to have these sorts of conversations about things that really matter. Taste does matter, it turns out. And that's why we have a radio show to do it. That's also why we have this radio network. Remember, it's the 29th of May. You still have a few days left in our membership drive. Heritage Radio Network is a membership-supported organization. We need you. We need you to support us so that we can continue to have these incredible conversations with people you might not get a chance to talk to. Also remember, always feel free to email us or tweet us. You can find all the details at heritageradionetwork.org, where you can also join. Next week, we're really pleased to be able to welcome an important, very important food person from Tel Aviv, the editor-in-chief of Israel's most important culinary magazine, Al HaShulchan. I've been practicing saying that. I hope I get it right. I'll have it right by next week when she's here. Jana Gur. Jana Gur is one of the world experts on Israeli food for obvious reasons. She's also incredibly knowledgeable about food all over the world. And we are in the midst of a moment now in New York where we're benefiting from what's going on in Tel Aviv and around Israel with the new Israeli bakery breads you've heard me talk about before, Israeli chefs and restaurants and all sorts of things going on. So it's going to be a fascinating conversation. Come join us next week, Wednesday at 11. In the meantime, think about eating something that you've never eaten before, never thought you would ever even consider food. And when you do it, thank Andrew Zimmern for opening your eyes and your palate to that wonderful, hopefully wonderful, certainly enlightening experience. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.